Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Lamed Ched Amud Bet. By the last line, we had brought the Braita that explained to us the machlok between Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and the Chachamim, which is that Hayore the Nichsei Shavui. If a person goes down to the possessions of a Shavui, here it's a case where we have rumors or some evidence of the fact that they have passed away. Therefore, Ein Motzin Oto Miyado. There we don't take him out of the property. And even the Chachamim over there agreed to that position because there is evidence, or the overwhelming outcome in this situation will be that the person, the closest of kin that you put there, will be the inheritor of the land. We had the other side, which were Nichsei Ritushim, which is a case where the individual disappeared, but we have no information as to whether they left, where they went, why they left. Over there, even Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel agrees that you don't allow anybody to go down there because we have no evidence of the fact that he's not coming back or that there's something wrong. The question or the case where they argued was a case of Nichsei Nitushim. It's a situation in which the person went overseas, but we have no information about what happened to them. Or if they were taken into captivity, we have no evidence of the fact that they had passed away. In that case, the Chachamim say, don't touch the property. And Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says that they have a din like Nichsei Shavui. That they have the same din as Nichsei Shavui, which would bring in the Karov when we allow him to work the land. So now the Gemara is joins to clarify what exactly are the terminologies that were used here. We had three terminologies that were used in the Braita: Nichsei Shavui, Nichsei Nitushim, and Nichsei Ritushim. So the Gemara wants to know what are the definitions of those words of Nitushim and Ritushim. That's what we're up to. So Gemara says, Maishna Hanach Dekaruluhu Nitushim, Umaishna Hanach Dekaruluhu Ritushim. Why does it use the word Nitushim for the property of the individual went overseas, we don't know what happened to him, versus the one Ritushim? The Gemara explains, Nitushim de Baal Korcho, the case of Nitushim is where it was taken against their will. Dichtiv, Vashvit Tishmatena Unitashta, Afgato de Malko, that is something that is decreed by the king, or the king disowns you of your property. Here we're talking about the Shemitah. We're going to get to this later on in the Masechta with regards to Afgata de Malka. But in essence, the reason that the land lays foul during the Shemitah year is because the Kodesh Baruch Hu says, you can't do this. And that's what it says, Rashi says on Kuf Vav Amud Aleph, HaMelech Bitlo Milizor'a. Hashem said, you're not allowed to plant it. Varehi Kemo She'ena. It's as if it doesn't exist. It's as if that year is out of the books because Hashem forced you out. Again, later on in the Masechta, when we're dealing with years of planting or rights that a person sells, is the Shemitah year included or not included? This is almost like a force majeure event where God basically took the property away during that period of time. He suspended your rights to the property. And now we see from the word unitashta. So the word unitashta means something that's taken against your will, or where, for instance, in this case, where he's in captivity, and his inability to reach his property or to get back to his property is that he's been taken forcibly away. He's been taken into captivity. He's having trouble returning to the location. So that's why they used the terminology of Nichsei Nitushim. This was property that was, quote-unquote, confiscated against his will. Not that the property was confiscated, but he was confiscated away from the property against his will. It's interesting just to look in the Chumash, to look at the Machloket Rishonim, as to how to explain the Pasuk of Ashvi'it, Tishmatenu Netashta, which seems to be a duplicate Lashon, and what it refers to. Rashi and the Ramban al Torah argue about that, and not our Inyan, but it's still interesting even just to take a look at that. Ritushim means Midatan. That means of their own volition. Dichtiv, the Pasuk says. Now, they quote a Pasuk here from Hosea, and Rashi goes out of his way to explain that you have to look at the context of the Pasuk in order to understand what it means. It says, Im albanim ritusha. The way to translate it is that the mothers and their children were torn asunder. So that doesn't sound like a voluntary type of removal. That sounds like they were ripped away. So Rashi says that you have to look at the context of the Pasuk, and the Pasuk in Hosea, and he goes through a whole Pasuk and translates it. He says, Vikam sha'on be'amecha. That they will rise a din amongst your nation. V'chol mitzarecha yushad. And all of your strongholds, all of your bastions will be destroyed. Kishod shaman beit arbel v'yom milchama. And so then, this is the key element that Rashi says over here. Like the plunderers that come on the day of Arba'el, Rashi says, is where they lay in ambush. And the people of the city were not aware of the fact there was going to be an ambush. So everything is there. So it's like the day where the plunderers come on the day of war. And they come and everybody, Emal Banim Ritusha, and all the people are torn asunder. Rashi points out that in the Pasuk, it says over here, Umedekamar Yushad Kishod Shalman Beit Arbel Michlal Da'u Yoma Lav Bart Arbel Biyomim Chamahava. The fact that it uses the Kafa Dimyon in the Pasuk, which says Kishod Shalman Beit Arbel Biyomim Chamah, tells you that that's not what happened in this situation. So in the situation that's being described in the Pasuk, without the Kafa Dimyon, it's a case where the plunderers suddenly ambushed the city, and therefore everything's there, because the people didn't have any awareness to leave. They weren't warned ahead of time. But once you use the Kafa Dimyon, the case is that they were warned ahead of time. They knew that the enemy was coming. So what do? They abandoned ship. They all left. So you know why there were mothers and children that were there? It's because all the males packed out. I mean, that the men took off because they knew what was coming or heading their way, and they ran away. And that's what Rashi describes over here. Ella, morach, babalibam. They were in total fear. Behemo zvim emal banim. They left their wives and their children behind. Bochim lehemi dakat ayuyev. For the fear of the enemy, they abandoned their families. Shema yavo alehem. So that's why the pasuk here, brutasha, emal banim brutasha, it's not referring to the enemy. It's referring to the husband and the father who abandoned his children in this situation for the fear of the enemy that was approaching. So that's how Rashi describes or explains why the word here, rutasha, is used in a context of voluntarily leaving. And that's why we call them nechasim ritushim, is because of the fact that the person left voluntarily. He was not under duress when he left. And therefore, we can't assume that he's not coming back, or we can't assume that something bad happened to him. In that case, even Rabbi Shimon Gamliel agrees that we don't allow someone to go down to the property to work it. Tana, b'chulam shamim lahem ke'aris. We said that all of them, you assess like an aris. You remember before, this was the reasoning behind Shmuel's position. When Shmuel said that we allow the karov to go down to the nechasim of the individual, the shavui, is because we're not afraid of him wasting the field or ruining the field, because kulan shemin lehen karis. This is the source for Shmuel's position. All of them, we assess them like a sharecropper. Ahai. On which one of the sections of the Mishnah does this have application? Ilema ashvuin. If we're talking about the case where he's a shavui, the first case in the Braita, hashta zariz v'niskarava. Over there, we said that if he hears the guy's coming back and he grabs all the fruit, he should grab whatever he can. May the ashbach mibai. So there, if he gets everything on the field, then certainly he should get what he invested or that which he improved the field. I mean, it's no question that he gets paid out like an aris in this case, because he can even take more than that. He eats as much as he wants out of the field, because there the overwhelming evidence indicates the person's not coming back. And therefore he can eat in the field like an owner. And even if we hear that the person's coming back, he can grab whatever he can grab. So certainly, if he invested in the field and he didn't get anything out of it, we will pay him like an aris. That's given and obvious. Ela ritushim. So what you're going to say, it's referring to the case of ritushim. Va'amotzino tomi yadoktoni. The case of ritushim, even Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says we don't allow the karov to go down there. We don't allow anybody to touch the property. If they go down there, we take it away from them. We confiscate it from them. Ela anitushim. So it must be in the middle case of the Braita, which is the case where he's overseas, but we have no evidence. Leman, which of those two individuals does it affect? Rabbi Shimon Gamliel or the Rabbanan's position? Ilem of the Rabbanan. According to Rabbanan, Amrei Motzino Tomiyado. For the Rabbanan, Nitushim and Ritushim have the same din. We confiscate. We don't allow you to stay in the property. We throw you out. So it's clearly not speaking in their position. I Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Hamar Shamati Shen Nitushim Kishvuin. He said that Nitushim had the same din as Shvuin. We just indicated that Shvuin's obvious, that he gets like an aris, because he gets to take all the food, everything off the property. So Mar says, Kishvuim velo Shvuim. They are similar to those of the Shvuim, but not exactly alike. Kishvuim, they're like the property of someone who's a Shavui, again, there where we have evidence that he probably died, Deimotino Tomi Yado, that we don't confiscate it. Velo Shvuim, but it's not exactly like that property. Gilu Hotam Zoriz Viniskar, Over there, if he hears the person's coming back, he can run and grab as much as he wants. V'lohocha, shaminin leke aris. Over here, we only give him a payout like a sharecropper. So then the Gemara asks, umayshna meha detanan? Why is he given rights as a sharecropper? How is this different than the Mishnah? Hamotzi hotzaot al nechsei ishto. Someone who has the property of his wife. The property of his wife here refers to nechsei malog. In nechsei malog, the wife is the landholder, the owner of the land, and the husband is a leaseholder in the land. So he gets to utilize the land while they are married, and he gets the output of the land during that period of time. He's essentially a leaseholder, or he gets to get the benefits or the production of the land, while the wife is the underlying holder or owner of the land. So here he invests money in the land. Hotzi arbe, if he invested a lot, v'chal kima, and he only took off the land a very small amount, either that he harvested a little bit, or his investment hasn't paid off yet, or kima, he invested little, v'chal harbe, and he ate a lot. Mash hotzi, hotzi, mash achal, achal. What he invested, he invested, and what he ate, he ate. Meaning that we do not do an offsetting check to see that there was an equal amount of investment as well as benefit that he took away from the property. The assumption is when they're married for the long term. And so therefore, everything's done with a long-term perspective. So if he invested in the land, he expected to be married over the long term. If at some reason it terminates, right, then we're not going to give him a rebate for the investment. Because he's not going to withhold the investment because he assumes that his marriage will be intact or will be there for the long term. And same thing the way we're in, meaning that if he eats more than he invested in the land, we're assuming he's not going to destroy the land because he's in it for the long term. And he knows that he's going to have these nechsei malog for the long term. And if he strips the land, then it's going to hurt him just as much as it's going to hurt his wife. So in both those cases, we say, too bad. And whatever happened, happened. So the Gemara says, why don't we say the same thing over here? Whatever he invested. Whatever he took out, he took out. And that's it. We don't do any calculations. We don't do any sharecropper calculation in the back end. So Mar says, Haludamya elalaha. I gave it away a little bit in explaining it, but it's more similar to what we have over here. Whether it's, you see here, the Argmar has a girsa of the Tanan, but you can see on the side here it says, there the girsa is, Yaakov, Sivam Rav Chista, Motzi Otzaot on Nechsei Shtok Tana. Someone who invests in the Nechsei Malog of his wife, who is a ktana, k'motzi al nechsei acher dami. It's equivalent to investing in a third party's property. So here you have a different situation or slightly different setup. It's a case where he marries a ktana, not where the father married off the daughter. In that case, it's like any other marriage, it's a marriage d'oraita. Here we're speaking about a case where the daughter is married off midrabanan. Either the father passed away and her mother or her brother married her off, or she's a yitoma b'chaye avia, and then she marries. The problem there, or the risk there is, that the girl can walk away from the marriage at any time. She has a right of annulment. She has the right to miyun at any time. So the husband is always scared that the wife is going to walk out of the marriage, or simply annul the marriage and say, I don't like this marriage, I'm not interested in it. And the chachamim give her a right to walk out of the marriage until she becomes a gdolah. So for that reason, you have now a tension in the marriage, which is, if he invests in the property, he's afraid that he might lose it because she'll annul the marriage. If he strips the property down, we're worried because then that hurts the tana, the property of the tana. So what do we want to do? We want to ensure that he feels secure that if he invests in the property, he won't get hurt. And so therefore, that's what is brought out over here. Hamotzi hotzot anichsei shtok tana, kimotzi anichsei acher dami. It is like investing in a third party's property, and that means that you'll get paid out like a sharecropper. So we ensure that he will get paid out so he's not fearful of investing in the property. We incentivize him to invest in the property because we basically guarantee him that the worst scenario that he'll have is that he'll be a sharecropper. The upside is that he'll be here still married and he'll keep the whole output. The downside is, at worst, that he'll get paid back like an aris, so he won't lose money over here. That'll incentivize him to do it. Alma, kevin de lo samcha deate. Over there, since he's not reliant on the marriage, he's fearful of the dissolution of the marriage. Takinu le rabbonon. The rabbonon established a takana keiched de lo sedinu in order that he will not lose out. So hachanami, so too in our case, takinu le rabbonon keiched de lo sedinu. The same thing over here. We want the karov to invest in the property, not strip the property. The only way to ensure that is to basically guarantee him the fact that he's getting paid out like an aris. And so by guaranteeing him that he's going to get paid out like an aris, he will invest fairly in the property and he won't strip the property. Just like by the ktana, we do that for the husband in order to incentivize him to invest, as well as to make him comfortable that he will get paid out and not ruin the property or just try to plunder the property while he has the chance. So too by the karov, we have a similar situation. So these two scenarios are similar, not like a regular marriage where the assumption is when you go into the marriage, it's going to last for the duration and therefore you don't need to incentivize him because there the incentive is built in. Your marriage is going to be around for a long time. We assume you're going to take care of the nechseim alog because it's to your advantage. Over here where there's fear or there's a chance you might lose, we have to incentivize. And that's what the Chachamim did in this case, was incentivize him like an aris, which is that he's like a sharecropper. If you look at the Tosafot, the first line on Tosafot here, it says, "Chulan shemin lehem karis, and nitushim de Rabbi Shimon Gamliel kai, kedemesik beperish Rashi." In the end, the individual who this refers to is the nitushim according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, because that was the only case where it was applicable. Other cases we showed that it wasn't relevant. So the only case where it's relevant is this nitushim of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. And therefore, what he concludes is, "Dibishavoy sheshamashemetu," in a case where you have a shavoy where we heard or have rumors that he passed away, "Uchel kol haperot," he eats everything. "Vim yavoa balim kodem shiuchal haperot, ito kashar isin." But if the balim show up before he's been able to eat the produce of the land, then he gets the payout like a sharecropper, v'yachzir ashar, and he has to leave the rest behind. Uben nitushim, in the case of nitushim, delo shama shemet, in a case where we didn't hear he passed away, lo yuchal el peirot, el shamina peirot, shiuchal kishar risin, the mechzal l'shlish v'rivia, v'lo yuchal klum b'chinam. So the way that Rashi explains it is that there are actually gradations here in how we treat the person on the property. If the person's on the property because we have rumors that the shavui passed away, in that instance, he gets everything. He takes everything. The default scenario is he keeps everything. We protect him in a case where the balim showed up and he wasn't able to eat. We give him like an aris. Whereas in the case of nitushim, the way Rashi explains it is up front, he only gets like an aris. That will be his position. So he'll collect as an aris every year. The remainder of the production we'll put into escrow and keep for the karov. So if the balim show up, they will get it. That's the way Rashi explains it. Tosafot goes through a series of questions, and then he goes in the end, "Lekach nira, devaday shekol haperot uchel b'chinam, v'im zaval v'charash v'zara ubalim ba'u kodem shekatzar yitol karis skar tirchol v'amalo." In the end, Tosafot backs away from it and says that even in a case of nitushim, you will be allowed to eat the whole production of the field. If the balim don't show up, you get to keep everything, and it's only if the balim show up that we say that you are treated like an aris. And therefore, the only difference between them will be zariz v'niskar. In the case of the shavui, if you hear he's coming, he can go and grab as much as he wants because he's really entitled to everything on the field. And so he can pull out of whatever he wants or as fast as he wants. In the case of the nitushim, he will have the right to eat the whole field. But if we hear that the owner's coming back, then we'll throw him off the land and say, you only get paid out like an aris. And then he says, "V'hashta parach shapir," and therefore that's why the Gemara has a question. "Kemi shochol kol haperot, kishiyavoa balim kodem shilaket, amayinu tel karis." If he's given the benefit of eating everything before the balim show up, why then when the balim show up does he get paid out v'ein aris? Tfei me motzio tzot anichse isho. More than the situation of someone who invests in his wife's land. Because basically what the Gemara is suggesting is, if he gets enough benefit out of the land, he won't worry about investing. So here, if he gets all the production of the land in a normal scenario, and only if the balim show up, he'll lose out, that should be enough of an incentive, or that should be an investment. The Gemara in the end concludes, he won't do it. It's too risky. His investment on any given year is at risk, because yes, he might get 100%, but he might get zero. And therefore, he's not going to do it. And so what we do is we incentivize him by saying, you're guaranteed in the back end to get paid out like an aris. And that's how Tosafot in the end concludes that the difference between nitushim and shavui and the last three lines of Tosafot, you can say about hachem nitushim and bo balim emini chondon litlosh kevin delo mafsid midei deshamin en luhu karis. Since he loses nothing because he gets paid out like an aris in this case, then we don't worry about him losing or worried about the land. what Tosfot says is, and that's the key difference between them, which is, in the case of the Shavuot, he gets the whole thing. Plus, if he hears the Balei Merkanim, he can take whatever he wants. Therefore, we may not even have to treat him like an Aris, because in most cases, he would have taken out enough before the Balim show up. And the lower probability of the Balim return give him enough incentive to invest in the land. In our case, once we know the Balim are coming back, he can't take anything. But we do guarantee him that if he didn't get anything out of the property that year, that he will get paid out as an Aris in the back end. And so that's how we protect the property. But Tosafot narrows the difference between a Shavuot and a Natush versus Rashi, who sees a big gap between them, which is Rashi treats the Natush as an Aris through and through. He gives him no rights to take the full production of the property. All right, now the Gemara asks over here, V'chulan shamin lehen ki'aris. The word kulan, this is a Bavli type of question all the time. As soon as you say kol, kulan, or you give klau, zeh, klau, the Bavli know, what did you include? Besides that which is written here, what does this general statement include? V'chulan ne'etuyei mai, what does that come to include? U'tei had amar of Nachman amar Shmuel, shavui shenishba, moridim karov nechasav. Yatza ledat, ein moridim karov nechasav. So here he brings Rav Nachman, the name of his Rebbe Shmuel, that you're allowed to put a karov into the property. That we know from Shmuel's statement before. The thing that we actually get here, what Tosfot points out, the chiddush that we didn't know before is, yatza ledat, ein moridim karov nechasav. If he goes out voluntarily, then we don't give any right to the karov to in there. Rav Nachman didei, amar boreach, harehu kishavui. Rav Nachman adds in over here that someone who runs away has a din of shavui. Boreach machmat mai. Why did he run away? Ilema machmat kargo. If he left because of the poll tax, or really here, kargo is the land tax. It's used in both contexts. In the Gemara, here it's clearly referring to land tax. He's afraid of the land tax. He doesn't have the monies to pay for it, and the king's coming around to collect it. It's a yearly collection of the land tax. So when it says, Haino ledat, that's leaving voluntarily or in a calm scenario. It's not something that happens suddenly. He knows when the king comes to collect the tax. He knows he doesn't have the money to do it. So he plans accordingly. He takes off. But before he takes off, he instructs people to what to do or how to deal with the land or what he's left behind. So that's the equivalent of leaving voluntarily, where we don't put a karov into the land. Ella boreach machmat mardin. It's a case where he's running away because of a death penalty. So here, Rashi equates this to actually what we saw in the Gemara in Baba Kama, that the Persian law indicates that there is a death penalty for someone who kills another party. And so here he's afraid. Sounds like he murdered someone or he had killed someone. And now he's subject to a death penalty. So he's running away because they're coming after him to prosecute him, execute him. And so there, it's not something that he has time to organize his affairs. This is something where he's got to take off right away. He's got to get out of there. And so there, this is the equivalent of a shavui, according to Rav Nachman. And that's what the kol comes to include. It comes to include that case where a person leaves involuntarily. He leaves under duress because he is in a rush to leave and he didn't organize his affairs. He has the same din as a shavui, which is we're going to help him out. We have to take care of him because, first of all, we have no idea when he's coming back. It's risky for him to come back for a long time. And we know that he didn't have time to organize his affairs before he left. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Shavui shenishba, a shavui that was taken into captivity. V'niach kama liktzor, and he left behind grain, standing grain that was ready to be harvested. Anavim liktzor, or grapes that were ready to be picked. Tmarim ligdor, or dates that were ready to be taken off the tree. Zeitim limsok, olives that were ready to be collected. Beitin yordim nechasav, Beitin enters in, umamidin apitropus. They put in an executor or some sort of agent in there to take care of it. V'kutzer u'butzer v'gudero mosek. He finishes off the harvest. V'achar kach moridim karov nechasav. And then afterwards we put in a karov to take over the property. So we don't allow the karov in at that point in time. We only allow the karov in after we've already taken care of the standing harvest. And then we let the karov go into the property. It says, well, once you got somebody in there, an executor or an agent of the beit din to do this, just leave him in there. Why are you bringing in a karov after that to manage the property? Leave in beit din's appointee. It says, here it sounds like we don't do this. But the way Rashi phrases it, the Ritva phrases it, is that beit din won't find And apitropos lidignani. Dignani means the zakein. But for older people, you cannot find an apitropos. And that is, if you have yitomim, if you have orphans, then a person is willing to be an apitropos for two reasons. Rashi says the mitzvah. It's a mitzvah. The person feels like he's doing something to take care of the yitomim. So he's willing to, free of charge, come in and help out the yitomim as a gesture of goodwill, where he wants to do the mitzvah and take care of the yitomim. The Ritva says that it has a time expiry to it. He knows that when the yitomim grow up, he's done with the job. The job is not an endless job. So for those two reasons, a person is willing to be an apitropos for a katan or apitropos for yitomim. The other hand, when you're talking about a gadol here, when you're talking about someone's a gadol is in captivity, you're lacking both of those pieces. People don't feel like it's a mitzvah because the person's a gadol. You're not coming in to take care of somebody who can't take care of themselves of yitomim. Here they're appointing an executor to come in and take care of the land on behalf of this person. So the people don't view it as a mitzvah. It might be a mitzvah anyway because the person can't do it. But they don't view it in that manner. Taking care of orphans is very different than taking care of somebody who is self-sufficient. And number two is there's no time limit on this. How do you know when this is going to end? So people aren't willing then to go and do this as pro bono work for the individual. So the Beit Din's not going to find an apitropos to come in on an unlimited basis to take care of the property. So here, if they have a discrete thing that they need the apitropos to do, people are willing to help out the Beit Din or help out another person and take care of the discrete event. But to leave them in there endlessly, they won't do that. So that's what the Gemara sets up here, is that we first put in an apitropos to deal with the harvest, and then we bring in the korov to deal with the property afterwards, because we won't find an apitropos to continuously deal with the land. The reason being is that in the case here where the harvest is standing, we don't want to stick the korov in there because the korov is not really entitled to any benefit over here. He's done nothing in return for the harvest that is standing. So what we want to do is get the apitropos to take out the harvest and put that into escrow for the baalim. Then we'll let the korov in, let him invest in the property and be treated like a sharecropper. So then that there is a quid pro quo. He's working the land, he's taking the land, and then he'll get something out of it. What we don't want him to do is come in and get a freebie here, which is take the harvest out that he did nothing for, and then all of a sudden he'll get a percentage of that output. So we're trying to avoid that. So we do that through the apitropos, where we can preserve that value for the baalim. Then the subsequent years we'll put in a karov. So now Gemara says, Amar Rav Huna, ein moridin katan nechse shavui. Rav Huna makes three statements here. The first of which is, we don't allow a katan to go down to nechse shavui. So here what we said before, the closest of kin is allowed to enter into the property of a shavui. Rav Huna limits that and says that's only if he's not a katan. Velo karov lenechse katan. We don't allow a relative into the property of a katan. Velo karov machmat karov lenechse katan. And not the relative of a relative into the nechasim of a katan. The Gemara now explains. Ein moridin katan lenechse shavui. We don't allow the katan to go down into the property of a shavui who left his property behind. Dilma mafsid lahu. Because he might ruin them. He's not a responsible party. And since he's not a responsible party, he's going to cause damage, or he's going to be problematic in terms of his dealing with the land. So we don't want the katan going down. It's not an effective way to deal with the problem. If the whole point of putting a karov into the land is to ensure that it doesn't deteriorate and make it productive on behalf of the baalim, putting a katan in there is not a sure way to do that. It's almost doing just the opposite. It's very likely that he will wreck the land and not help out the land. So that's the first of the dinim. Now, lo karov, machmat karov nechse katan. We don't allow a karov who is a relative or relative into katan. Bachei ima. That's a case where it's the brother from the mother. So here you have, just make it easy, you have A, B, and C, or Reuben, Shimon, and Levi. Reuben and Shimon, or A and B, are related through their father. They have a common father. B and C, or Shimon and Levi, are related because they have a common mother. That means as far as Reuven and Levi, or A and C, are concerned, they have no relationship to each other. So what we don't allow is, we don't allow Levi or C to come into the property and work it. The reason being is because of the next line here, which is, V'lo karov v'nechse katan. We don't allow a relative into the nechassim of a katan. Kevin de lo machi atelech zukebe. Since the katan will not object to his being there, he'll end up taking possession of the land. He'll end up claiming that it is his. So We know that when a person's in the land for a duration of time, that duration gives them rights, assuming that they have a claim to the land. So there are different valid claims. We'll spend a lot of time with this on Bava Batra. But one claim can be that I bought it from you, and then you're there for 3 years. If you say I bought it from you in the other 3 years, that's a valid claim, and you don't have to bring any more evidence there because of the fact that you were there for Shnot Chazaka. Another valid claim is that I inherited the land. I'm now here for 3 years because I was the inheritor of the land. So the risk of a karov, the karov here is someone who would inherit alongside of this child. We don't allow that person to work the land on behalf of the child because of the risk that years down the road, this individual is going to say, it was my inheritance. And that's a valid claim. And the katan has no way to object. He doesn't know any better to object over here, and he will never object. So this person will attain levels of chazakah and have a valid claim to the property through Yerusha. Now, if someone said, and we'll see this in a second, the Gemara is going to say this, that if someone said that they bought it, that will not be considered a valid chazakah, because you can't establish a chazakah vis-a-vis a katan. So that's the problem over here. But with Yerusha, that doesn't happen, because Yerusha always happens that way. There might be ketanim involved. And he's not saying that I bought it from the katan, I bought it from your father. He's just simply saying I inherited it. So now, that's the first problem. That's why we don't put in a relative into the property of a katan. Now, why don't we put a relative for the same problem? Because now, if you have Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, Reuven is a katan. Shimon, his brother, we don't put into the property. We just explained why. We also will not put in Levi into the property, who's a relative of Shimon, but not a relative of Reuven, because what he'll do in the end is say the same thing. He'll say that the reason that I'm in this property is because this was my mother's property. My mother brought this in the dowry into the marriage, and it was Nichsei Malog. Your father, meaning the common father, Reuven Shimon, passed away. He predeceased his wife. That means that the property goes back to the wife, or then goes to the children of the mother. The children of the mother are Shimon and Levi. So what Levi in the end will say is, this property belonged to our mother, and that's why I'm in the property. So he'll make a claim on behalf of himself and his brother through the mother that will take the property that is rightfully Reuven's away. So that's why we don't allow a relative of a relative. Now, it's in this scenario. It's this particular scenario where you have a brother through the father and then a brother to that brother through the mother. Because in that case, you have a risk that he can also make a claim of Yerusha, and we don't want him doing that because he will disown the katan from the property. So those individuals are precluded from being the, we'll call them the protectors, the executors of the property of the katan, because of the risk that they might actually keep the property for themselves. So now, Amar Rava, Shmami Neid Rav Huna, from the words of Rav Huna, you would conclude, Ein Machzikim in Ichsei Katan. You cannot establish a chazakah in the property of a katan, Afilu Higdil, even if he gets older. So now, what Rava does is explains what I just noted to you, which is the fact that you can establish a chazakah here in the katan's property through Yerusha indicates that you cannot establish a chazakah through a transaction. Which means that if you make a claim that I bought the property from your father, and then I've been working the land for 3 years, and that's why I'm here. I have a chazakah, and I have a claim, which is I bought it from your father. I don't need a shtar. That doesn't work. Why? Because the years that you worked it were in front of the katan, and the katan himself doesn't have the ability to object. He doesn't know to object, or doesn't know better to object. So his lack of objection is not an acquiescence to your ownership of the property. Generally, we view chazakah as being the owner's acquiescence to the other party's claim to the property, because they don't object to them being there. Over here, the lack of objection is a lack of knowledge. It's the katan's inability to object. How does he know that? Because Rav Huna only precludes a karov, a relative, from entering into the property. What he doesn't preclude is a third party coming in and managing the property of the katan. Well, how could you let a third party in there? He'll establish a chazakah and then say, I bought it from your father. The fact that we don't worry about that shows you that you cannot establish a chazakah in that case. And afilu sheigdil, even if the katan now is of age, his lack of objection is not sufficient grounds over here, because he only is not objecting when he became older is because he didn't know any better when he was a katan. If the whole incident started when he was a katan, then you can't claim chazakah even when he gets older. He's been bar mitzvah for 3 years now, and I should be entitled to keep the property. I have a chazaka, and he didn't object when he got older. Well, the reason he didn't object when he got older is because he didn't object when he was younger. He knows no more information now than he did earlier. If the whole event started once he's older, then of course, then that's the situation, that you can establish a chazaka. But no, here's a case where the event or the whole experience started when he was a katan, so he knows no better to object in this case. So Tosfot asks your question. Tosfot says that there are a million mishnayot that say what Rav Huna says. He says, "Vikasha, the below Rav Huna, kam mishnayot, yesh mamidim apitropos, nechse yitomim." You need Rav Huna to come and tell you that? We have mishnah after mishnah in Shas that says that you put an apitropos into a katan's property. That already established the fact that you can't make a chazaka in a katan's property. The fact that you put an apitropos is valid enough. So Tosfot says in the end, he says, "Veishlamar, dilav Rav Huna, if you had, did not have Rav Huna, yeshlamar mashim mamidim apitropos nechse yitomim, just because you put in an executor does not mean that you can't establish a chazaka. The beitin lo yuvararu kim ne'aman. The beitin will only let in an apitropos who is trustworthy to them. Or they'll teach the katan to reject it every 3 years. So if it were just from the mishnayot, you could say, and I think that's what you were suggesting before, that an apitropos is a unique position. The fact that Beit Din appoints him either means that this is a person who is trustworthy. We know that from the Gemara and other places, that the Gemara says that an apitropos benefits from being an apitropos because it shows that Beit Din trusts him. It gives him a stamp of approval as a trustworthy individual. If that's the case, then he's also not going to be someone who steals from the Ketanim. Or the Beit Din makes sure that the Ketan knows to reject the ownership every 3 years. But once Rav Huna came along and said that we don't allow Karovin, but we do allow third parties in, meaning that any third party, even not an apitropos who is a appointee of Beit Din, then all of a sudden it opens up the possibility that we have people here who are not Nemanim. So what that must mean, or the conclusion of that is, that there is no chazaka in the property of a katan. Velo Amran, we only say this, elubei achei da abba. That's only true when it is a relative through the father. But relatives to the mother, we don't worry about it. So not in a case of the double relative, but in a single relative. The only problem is when it's his brother through the father. If it's his brother through the mother, there's no problem over here. He can't make a claim of Yerusha over here. They don't have a shared Yerusha. And his brother through his father, you also don't say, when we're dealing with land. But when we're talking about housing or other property, it's not an issue. Rashi says, interesting, shashchenim meidim alehem, because the neighbors will indicate who is the real owner of the property. In that, especially in their day where they left, or maybe even today, where you live in density or close density, the neighbors knew about each other's business, and therefore the neighbors know that this katan is the real owner of the house or the real yoresh of the house. When you're talking about fields that are outside the city or in the bik'ah, nobody knows what the real ownership or who is the true owner or who's the yoresh of the property. So over there it's less clear, and that's where there's risk. But with the houses, there's no risk. The truth is that by land, it's only in a case where they didn't make an idita, which is a shtar chaluka, where there was a document that documented the Yerusha and how the Yerusha was divided. Remember, anything that is documented, signed in Beit Din has a kol to it. It's something that's considered as if it's registered in a registry, and therefore everybody knows about it. If you already did something like that, then everybody knows how it was divided, and the guy can't make a claim and say, oh, but that wasn't my brother's, it was mine, I was Yoreshit. No, we have the shtar chaluka. Obviously, it's in a case where the shtar was lost. If we have the shtar, then there's evidence already of the fact. The fact that it was done with the shtar originally means that there's information out there that people will be able to testify about. Gemara says, Velohi. Gemara rejects all of these qualifications and says, Loshna achid abba, Veloshna achid ima. We don't care whether it's a relative to the father or a relative through the mother. In either case, we reject it. The reason being that even with the mother, there's a risk. Because he can say, our father predeceased our mother, and she had her nichse malo came back to her, and now we are shared inheritors of our mother's property, and I'm the inheritor of this property. Loshna arata veloshna bate. Doesn't matter about the land, or doesn't matter about the houses. There, the assumption being that we don't rely on the neighbors to correct the problem. Loshna avid idita, loshna lo avid idita, lo machtinan. Doesn't matter if they put an Eshtar Yerusha or didn't put an Eshtar Yerusha. We don't allow relatives to go in there. Tosfot asks that in the Gemara in Baba Batra, it sounds like we do allow them in if they're itata kala itlehe. Yesh lamar, biyitomim echmiru yoter. Tosfot says, biyitomim, even though an itata has a kol, and we rely on that for certain halachot, biyitomim, it's just too risky, and we don't allow them in. We want to protect the yitomim. The way that it worded by Rabban Gamliel in the Gemara, as well as by in secular law today, that the Beit Din is the father of the Yitomim, and they're going to act on their behalf. And therefore, in order to protect the Yitomim, they're not going to allow relatives in there, period, even with all this other information that's out there, because we want to ensure that Yitomim get their property. They are the weakest link in society. They can be taken advantage of the easiest. And therefore, we'll go out of our way to make sure that there's nobody who has a claim against them or could take away their property. And so now we have an interesting story. There was this older woman who had three daughters. Ishtavai. She was taken in captivity. Ihi, her, v'chada brato, and one of the daughters. So she has three daughters. One of the daughters and her are taken into captivity. Idachtarte benoto, the other two daughters, shchiva chada minayu, one of them passed away, the shavka yenoka, and she left behind a katan. So now, in the scenario you have the mother and one of the daughters in captivity, you have one daughter that's here, and then one of the remaining daughters who passed away has a young child that's here. So Amar Abaye Echinavit, what are we going to do in this scenario? Lukminu the nichse biyadad achto. So what are we going to do? We're going to put the property in the hands of the one daughter that is still here, Dilma Shchiva Safta. Wait a minute. Maybe the mother will pass away. Vein moridin karov nichse katan. And then this woman is going to be acting as an executor or a protector for the katan. Because in that case, if the mother passes away, there are three inheritors of the land, the daughters in captivity with her, the daughter that's here with us, and the katan. He'll be, in place of his mother, he'll be the third inheritor over here. Now, if she is working the property and the mother passed away, that means she's now taking care of her nephew's property, which she's not allowed to do. Because we already said that, ain moridim karov nixei katan. Nukminu nixei biyadad yinoka. So maybe we'll put it in the hands of the katan. Dilma lo shchiva safta. Maybe the mother didn't pass away. Bein moridin katan nixei shavoy. And then the property all belongs to the mother, and now you have Katan who's taking care of the property of a Shavuy, which is not allowed because we're afraid he's going to destroy it. Amar Abaye. So therefore he says, Hilkach, Palginan Yavina La Laachto. We give a half to the sister. Now, that's because the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Shmuel Paskins like him, and the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, that by Nichse Shavuy we allow a Karov to go down. So we give half of the property to the sister that is present. Vidak palga mukmini le apitropo the yinoka. And the other half we put in an apitropos for the young child. So now in this case, there are two possibilities of what the outcome are, which is either the mother passed away, and therefore the yinoka is entitled to a third, the other sister is entitled to a third, and the sister in captivity is entitled to a third. In that case, we're fine because we have one sister taking care of her third, plus a sixth of her sister's property that is in captivity. We have an apitropos who's taking care of the katan's property, plus the sixth of the sister who is in captivity. If the case is that the mother did not pass away and she's still in captivity, then over here we have two adults that are taking care of the property, which is fine. And you're allowed to be morid karov, the nichsei of a shavui. So the sister will be there and the apitropos. If both the mother and the daughter in captivity had passed away, then again, you're in a good situation. The sister who's here, she's entitled to half the property, and she already has it. The katan is entitled to half the property. We have an apitropos who's on half the property. So in that case, we've solved all permutations, and in all permutations, we're not in quote-unquote violation of the law, and we allow the property to be taken care of on behalf of the tome, as well as on behalf of the shavui. But Rav Amar, Rebbe says, wait a minute. Migo de mukminen apitropo de palga, mumbrin le atropo de idach palga. Once we're already gonna put in an apitropos for half of it, let us put in an apitropos for everything. Meaning that, if you already get an apitropos to deal with half the property, what's the big deal for him to deal with the other half of the property? He's gonna come and do it because you have a yatom here, you have a young child that he needs to take care of, so you're gonna find an apitropos. Once he's managing it, let him manage the whole thing rather than half of it. That way we're in a much safer position, because then we can always make the determinations after the fact and move it around. You don't have to worry about half of it with the sister and half of it with the apitropos. What's interesting over here is that the fact that we're choshesh, that the mother passed away, is difficult. Because we know that from the Gemara in Gittin, that ain't choshishin the mita. We assume that everybody's alive. Unless we have information to the contrary, we assume that they are alive. So why all of a sudden over here, where this woman is taken into captivity, are we starting to worry that she has passed away? Before in the Gemara we said we only worry about that when we have a Shavuot, plus we have rumors, or Rabbi Tosfos said, Eid Echad, we have some evidence of the fact that they passed away. Otherwise, we don't necessarily worry about Mita. How come we're worried about Mita over here? Tosfot gives a very interesting answer here. It says, Yosh Loma de Safta Igia Ligvurot. This was a very elderly woman. Once you reach that age, she's crossed over the threshold where we don't worry about Mita anymore. She's already called closer to death than to being alive. So to say that it is a case where she passed away. That's interesting. Many of the Rishonim reject this answer of Tosafot because it seems difficult to make that explanation. In general, we don't say that. We don't say it at all. We always assume a person's alive. For instance, if they send a korban for overseas, and they're a zakein, or they send a get from overseas, we always assume that the person's alive and the get is valid, or that the korban is valid and has balim. So why over here is it different, or why is this such an exceptional case? What most explain is that in the case of shvuya, in the case of captivity, that is an extreme case. And we mentioned this yesterday, that in the case of shvuya, the assumption is that most people are not coming back alive from those situations. So over there already, there's reason to be choshesh for the mita, is because you're in a circumstance or situation where inami hochash nishbu chayshin tfei dimo metu lefish asu lehem isurim. I mean that in captivity, there's a higher likelihood that the people die, whether that's only when they're older or period. Then Tosfot makes that, and that's what most of Rishonim hang on, which is that the fact that this is a situation of captivity already makes it that there is a larger chashash that the person might have passed away. And therefore, we have to take into consideration, if we're doing this division, that there is that possibility that she has passed away. Alright, so now, the Sof Shemo Deshchiva Savto, and then they get word of the fact that the elderly woman passed away. Amar Abayi, Tilto Yavina La'achto. So now we have three inheritors of the land. The one daughter is in captivity, the daughter that's here, and the nephew who is a katan. So what Abayi says is, we give a third to the sister that is here. V'tilta yavinan le yinoka. We give one third to the katan. V'idach tilta yavinan danka la'achta. V'idach danka mumukinim le apitropa le yinoka. So then what we do is we give a third to the sister here, a third to the katan, and then the last third, which is possibly belongs to the sister who's in captivity and might be still alive, or possibly should be split between the two that are here. So for a sixth of it, we give it to the sister that's here. Because either it's hers, or she will be a protector and apitropos for her sister who is a gdola. That we allow because a gdola will know to reject the position of her sister. It's not a ktana. On the other hand, the other sixth of the property of the daughter who's in captivity, that we cannot give to the sister that's here because that's the property possibly of a katan. Ve'im machnisim karov v'nichsei katan. On the other hand, we can't give it to the katan because it maybe belongs to the girl who, the woman who is in captivity. So what do? We appoint the papitropos for that one-sixth of the property. Rava again says, Rava Amar, Migo de mikum apitropo le danka, mumukmimi nami atropo le ikach danka. If you're already going to put an apitropos in for a sixth of the property, then put the apitropos in for the other sixth of the property, I mean for the full third of the property that belongs to that sister that is overseas. So here the Gemara doesn't mention anything about an apitropos for the katan, which is interesting, because it just says you give it to the yinoka, you give it to the katan, because it's his property. So here the Gemara assumes that you're giving it to the katan and not appointing an apitropos for the katan, which is interesting, because before they thought that they needed an apitropos for the katan. Over here the Gemara says, give it to the katan, and then apitropos for the property that is in the middle, because you can't have a karov come into nixei katan. It's very interesting. So when the katan's property himself, there we're allowing him to deal with it. Where it's someone else managing the property, there we say it's got to be an apitropos on his behalf. An interesting dynamic in terms of the Gemara. Maybe they did appoint an apitropos separately for the katan. The Gemara is just not speaking about that. Or there is a possibility that there are age brackets. A katan here is generally seen someone who's underage, and therefore he's a yatom. The Rambam and some other Rishonim mentioned this, that the Gemara notes that a person shouldn't be transacting in his father's land until he's 20. So there is a gap between the time they become a gadol and the time that they're transacting. So it might be that you have, quote-unquote, a katan, where he is old enough to manage his own property, but we won't allow him in to manage other people's property. And so that might be here in this situation, where he is old enough to, we'll leave him his property, but he's not old enough where we'll allow him to be the one who manages the property, or that someone else manages the property on his behalf. So there might be that gap in age between 13 and 20 where you have that issue where it's in limbo state for the katan. We'll call him quote-unquote a katan. All right, now, I have an interesting story now, which is Mari Bar Yisak. Mari Bar Yisak was back on the Gemara and Daf Kanchav Beram and Aleph, which Amemar Marzuch Ravashi Iklu the Bustanai de Mari Bar Yisak. They came to the orchard of Mari Bar Yisak back on Chav Beram and Aleph, and there that was the whole question of Shelo Shlomidat, the Aris gave him fruit, and whether you should eat from it, not eat from it. That's a story by Mari Bar Yisak. That was a nicer story by Mari Bar Yisak over here. It's a little bit of a more critical story of Mari Bar Yisak, but not necessarily so, totally negative. Atale Acha mi Beit Hozai. All of a sudden, a brother of his shows up from Beit Hozai. Beit Hozai, we've actually noted in the Gemara before, is an area where it wasn't as Jewish, and it's actually people who lived there, it sometimes had questionable lineage. It's actually much closer to the Persian Gulf than the main Jewish settlement, which was further up by the Euphrates River, Tigris-Euphrates Rivers. He had a brother that shows up from Beit Hozai. Amalei Plogli, I want my half of the property. We are both brothers. Our father passed away. I want my share in the property over here. Amalei Lo Yadanuch, I have no idea who you are. Atal the Kamei Rav Chista. It went before Yechista. Amalei Shapir Kamalecha. Rav Chista says to the brother who came to Beit Hozai that he's not necessarily lying. Now, whether he was doing this just to placate the brother and say, don't think that Mari Bar Yisak's just an out-and-out liar, or whether he was trying to explain the situation, which we'll see in a second, might account for the fact that Mari Bar Yisak doesn't really know who he is. Which goes, Shenemar, Vayaker Yosef et Echav, Veim lo yikiruo. When the brothers come down to Mitzrayim, Yosef recognizes his brothers, but they do not recognize him. Milameid sheyatzah b'lo chatimat zakan. That when Yosef left, he had yet to grow his beard. He had yet to fully mature. Uba b'chatimat zakan. On the other hand, when they came down to Mitzrayim, he had now grown into a full-grown man, and he had a beard already. So the aging of an individual, there is this crossover, both at the age of puberty, but also as the person crosses over from the teenage years, adolescence, into adulthood. In that period of time, the face of the individual changes, or their look changes, especially if you wear a beard. So what Rav Chista points out is that it was not implausible that Yosef recognized his brothers, because when he had left, they were already all adults, and they already had their beards, and so there wasn't much change between the time that he had seen them last and the time that they came down. On the other hand, for Yosef, who was 17 when he left, and now he's 39, right? He's a full-grown man at this point in time, and therefore their ability to recognize him is very difficult because of that dynamic change in his face and his facial features. And so he's saying the same thing over here, that the situation is similar, which is that one of two things happened here. According to Rashi over here, Mari Bar Yisak lived by his family in Beit Hozai and then left them while this brother was still a youngster. So now he's over here, and the reason what Rav Chisda is saying is he doesn't recognize you is he left you as a young kid. Now you're coming here. His claim is not invalid because he probably really doesn't recognize you. The way Rashi and Tosafot explained it in Yevamot, they actually have it the other way around, which is that everybody used to live here by where Mari Bar Yisak is, and then they moved. When this brother was a youngster, the father and the young brother moved to Beit Hozai, and they left Mari Bar Yisak. But either way, Mari Bar Yisak's separation from this brother was when this brother was very young. And so Rav Chisda says, it's not implausible that he doesn't recognize you. Now, in terms of Yosef, there are a number of other factors that also contribute over there. One of them is context, which is that you could be walking through an airport, and you walk by people that you know, but you don't even see them because you don't expect them to be there. And same thing here. The brothers don't expect Yosef to be down in Mitzrayim. So when they come down there, even though they're maybe looking at Yosef, they're not thinking Yosef. And so together in combination with this, that might be why they don't recognize Yosef. On the other hand, Yosef expects the people of Canaan are coming down to buy food, and his brothers were older when he left. In combination, that might be a factor. The additional factor is that in Egypt in those days, the king or the princes wore masks. So that also might be a contributing factor. That's Afnat Paneach, which Yosef is called by Paro. So Chizkuni says that. I'm saying there are other contributing factors over there. But Rav Chisda marshals that as a proof to the fact that Mari Ba'isach might not just be outright lying and denying the fact. He might genuinely not recognize his brother over here. Samarle Zil Aiti Sade Dachuat says, go bring Edim that you're his brother, that you're Mari Ba'isach's brother. Amarle Idli Sade, he says, I have witnesses, V'dachale Mine, but they're afraid of Mari Ba'isach, De Gavra Alimahu, because he's a strong man, meant that he's a bully. So this is a little negative part of the story here, that Mari Ba'isach, as being a rich, wealthy individual, also carried weight with that, and that weight he could wield against people. So the Edim are afraid to testify against Mari Ba'isach, because they're afraid that he might take retribution on them or cause them a lot of trouble. Samalei, Lididei, Zil'ant, Ait Isade, Dalabachuchu. So he turns around to Mari Ba'isach and says, you bring Edim that he is not your brother. So now Tosfot already says, whoa, wait a minute. How could you ask for that? That is a really difficult thing to do in this case, because that means that in any scenario where you have a wealthy individual who carries a strong arm, you're going to demand of him to deny that any person is his brother. That means that the burden of proof is on him. You know what's going to happen? There's going to be a line out the door of the Beit Din of all these people claiming that they're the brother of this individual, because the burden of proof is on him to show that they're not the brothers. That's a really difficult thing to put a person in a position like that. So what the Baalei Tosafot in the end say is, no, that this is a unique case. Why? Because here, Mari Ba'isach did not deny the fact that he was his brother. He didn't say, I don't have a brother. He said, I don't know you. So what Tosafot says is that you can say this in one of two ways. Either he acknowledged that he did have a brother, he just doesn't think that this guy is the brother. He says, I don't recognize you as the brother. Or, even if he's denying the possibility that he has a brother, he still didn't say, I don't have a brother. He just said, I don't recognize you. So here, his Eino Yodeya already brings into the case. If someone definitively says that the guy's not my brother, then we don't put the burden of a proof on him to try to prove otherwise. The question here arises because Mari Ba'isach is not saying, you're not my brother. He's just saying, I don't recognize you. I don't know who you are. And that already opens up the possibility that he really is his brother and that Mari Ba'isach doesn't recognize him. That might be part of what Rav Chisda was noting before, which is that his denial is not a complete denial. So Amar Lei Dina Hachi. So Mari Ba'isach, smart guy, says back to him, that's the way the halacha is. Hamotzi michaveiro alav araya. The burden of proof is always the person pulling away from the person who's mukzak in the property. Mari Ba'isach says, I'm mukzak in the property. I don't have the burden of proof. The burden of proof is on him. So Amar Lei, so Chisda says back to him, Haichi danina lecha l'chol alimi dechavreich. That's what I deal with people like you, strong men like you. That's how I deal with you and all your friends like that. And not that in every situation the person would have the burden of proof to bring Edim that he's not his brother, but here, since we know there are Edim out there that know the information, he put the burden on Mari Ba'isach to bring those Edim to court. That's what the Baalei Tosafot note over here. So obviously what he's telling him is that this is an unusual case, and putting the burden of proof on the other party is very difficult. But as we explained already in the Tosafot, it's not a complete burden of proof on this individual because it has to be a scenario where there's evidence or some indication that the brother really is a brother. Otherwise, you don't have a claim over here. So Amar Lei. So Mari Ba'isach says back to him, Sof, Ate Sade, Velo Masade. Says, what's the difference? If the Edim are afraid of me and they wouldn't come and testify for the brother, quote unquote, then when I bring them, you're telling me to bring the Edim, they're going to do the same thing over here. They're not going to say anything. Amar Lei, Tarte lo avde. They won't do two things. It's very interesting. He says that people are willing to abstain or act in omission in terms of not testifying to not get themselves in trouble. What people won't do is they won't also lie under oath or be an act of commission because they're afraid of you, Mari Ba'isach. In the case where your brother has to bring the Edim might just deny that they know anything.
That they're willing to do. They're willing to lie and deny that to get out of trouble or not to get into an altercation with Mari Ba'Yisak. But if Mari Ba'Yisak brings the Edim, now not only do they have to deny that they know anything, but now they have to lie and say that that's not his brother. He says they won't do that. Edim are willing to, again, omit, but not to commit, which is that they're not willing to lie actively to benefit you, Mari Ba'Yisak. They will walk away from it, but they won't lie. So, Nesof Atu Sadeh, Dahuahu. In the end, the Edim show up and say that it was his brother. Like Rav Chista predicted, the Edim, once they were brought in, were not going to lie on behalf of Mari Ba'Yisak. Amalei, Liflogli, Nami, Bipardisai, Ubustanai, the Shato. I also want half of all the orchards and vineyards that you worked on, you planted, and that you improved on the property. So now, he's asking here, not only for the core property to be split, because he is a brother, but he's saying now, you, Mari Ba'Yisak, invested in the property. You improved the property. When you improved the property, you improved it for both of us. So I'm entitled to half of that improvement as well. So Amalei, Rav Chisda says, Shapir Kamar Lecho. He's right about this. Ditznan, we have a Mishnah. Heiniach Banim Gdolim Uktanim. A father passes away, and there are children who are of age, and there are ktanim, there are youngsters here. Veishbichu gdolim et nechasim. And the children who are of age invested in the property. Hishbichu leemtza. When they improve the property, it's to the estate and not for their personal benefit. So that when they invest in the property, they're investing not only on their own behalf, but on behalf of their brothers who are ktanim. So the same thing over here. You, Mari Ba'Yisak, who in essence you were a executor of the estate, because only half of it belonged to you, when you improved it for both parties, not only for yourself, but also for your brother. V'chein amar Rabba, and Rabba says the same thing, ishbichu the emtza. When you improve it, it goes to emtza. Rashi says, whoa, wait a minute, we quoted a Mishnah, and then we're bringing in Rabba and Amora to back up a Mishnah? You don't find that anywhere in Shas. Never in Shas is the Gemara bringing Amora to back up a position of a Mishnah. Therefore, Rashi wants to take it out of the Girsa completely. He offers another alternative, which is, maybe it's not Rabba, but rather it is Rav. And that it says, V'chein amar Rav, ishbichu leemtza. The reason being that there is a machloket later on in the Gemara as to whether this is true, ishbichu leemtza. And if Rav is of the opinion over there that argues, then it would make sense. He says, V'igarisle, v'chein amar Rav, garsinan she rabosh Rav Chista. Because then Rav Chista is bringing his Rebbe, Rav, and saying, we paskin like the Emtza, based on that machloket. So Rashi is only willing to concede that if you leave it in, it's v'chein amar Rav. Otherwise, he wants it out of the Girsa completely. The Balei Tosafot, who are much more, especially like the Rabbeinu Tam, much more reluctant to take something out of the Gemara, change the Girsa, say that the Girsa is fine. First of all, they don't like the Girsa of Rav, because the arguing party in the Gemara later on is Rava. So you're going to say that Rava's arguing on Rav? We never find that in Shas, that Rav and Rava are arguing. So he says that, first of all, doesn't make sense. And number two is, he says that in the Sefer of the Rabbeinu Tam, he had this Girsa there. And therefore, what he wants to suggest is, he says, Ve'eviwa Gemara mishum kushat abaye. The Gemara is not saying, V'chein amar Rava, back up the position, but rather to entertain the questions that follow, which is Abaye, a Talmid of Rabba, challenges Rabba's assumption over here, or whether the application of Rabba is relevant over here. The fact that Abaye questioned him, and Rabba still stood his ground, shows us that Rabba believes the din is here, despite the questions of Abaye. And that's why the Gemara brings Rabba over here, not to back up the Mishnah, but rather to be Sholel, to reject the questions that Abaye raises over here. And that is, Amarle Abaye, Midomi. Why are the cases comparable? Hotam Gdolim Gabe Ktanim Yade Vikamachle. Over there, when you're talking about the Gdolim and the Ktanim, the Gdolim know that they're managing the estate on behalf of all the children. And therefore, when they invest, they're mochel on the part that goes to the Ktanim, because they know the Ktanim are inheritors of this property or one of the owners of the estate. So when they work the estate on behalf of all the brothers, they know that the Ktanim are going to take their portion of it. Hacha miyodo delechel. Over here, Mari Ba'Yisak never knew that he was investing on behalf of his brother. He was not aware of the fact that he's investing in Barry's brother. So how could he be mochel over here? The truth is that some of the Rishonim point out that it doesn't matter if it's a katan. Even if the gdolim and gdolim, as long as you're aware, you can be mochel. If you're not aware, you can't be mochel. That is Abaye's challenge to this. What the Tosfot are suggesting over here is Rabbah says his position despite this question of Abaye and thinks that it's true in either case. Galgo milto mata de kamei de Rabbi Ami. So this psak of Rav Chisda ended up coming before Rabbi Ami eventually. Amalahu yidolam izo amru. Even more than this, they said shamim lahen ki arish, that you assess them like an aris. Hashta didei lo yavinen lei. Over here, you're not going to give him what rightfully belongs to him. So even in a case where we allow a karov to go down to the property and the balim get the whole property back, shamin lahem karis, we give them at least some payback that they get paid out like a sharecropper. Over here, you're not going to give him at least like a sharecropper. I mean that when he invested in the property, he didn't even know it was someone else's property. There in the case of the karov that you bring down to the property, he knows it's someone else's property. And there you still give him like an aris. Over here, Mari Ba'isak thinks it's his property all along. Of course, he should at least give him like an aris. So fine, yes, you're going to give the property back to the brother, but he should still get a payout like a sharecropper in his brother's property. So as the Gemara says before, that when a person goes in and is mashbiach the property, ledat atzmo, we do give him a right to the property like an aris. Hashta didei lo yavin ani, here where he's a rightful owner of the property, you're not going to give it to him what he's entitled to? Hadruda ha lekame de Rav Chisda. So the case came back, remanded back to Rav Chisda, and then Rav Chisda says, amalu, mi domi. That's not a comparable case. Hatam birshut nachit. Over there he went down with permission. Hacha la birshut nachit. Over here he didn't go down with permission. Va'od katanu. Vein moridim karov nechse katan. So therefore, there is no right of collection over here. They pushed it back to Rabbi Chisda. Rabbi Chisda says the cases are not comparable at all. Over there, by the aris or by the karov that went into the nechassim, he did it with permission. Beit Din sent them and gave him permission to go there. Here, Mari Bar Yisak was doing it without the permission of the Beit Din or without any knowledge that he was doing on behalf of this other party. Number one. Number two is his brother was a katan. And then Mari Bar Yisak is not entitled to go in and work the property on behalf of the katan. So not only did he not have permission of Beit Din, he's in violation of the rule that you're not allowed to enter the property of a katan. So Adrua kamei de Rabbi Ami. So they brought it back, remanded the case to Rabbi Ami. Amarlo lo semua kamei de katanu. You guys never told me that the brother was a katan. Eino chanami that Rav Chisda is right, that if the brother was a katan, then Mari Bar Yisak had no right to be in the property. It seems, by the way, that he is okay with the fact that it was done, quote-unquote, without permission, because somebody had to work the land. And we allow a karov to go there. So even if it wasn't done explicitly with the permission of Beit Din, but in the end, he did what would have been done by Beit Din anyway. So that's why he's not necessarily bothered by that. But the problem of going into the property of a katan, that is a clear violation of the rules of Beit Din. And therefore, Mari Bar Yisak was not entitled to go into the property. And if that's the case, the katan is entitled to take his half of the property or everything that's there. And now Rabbi Ami and Rav Chisda are both given the same psak that Mari Bar Yisak has to give the property to his brother. Not only the property, but all the investment he made, which was quote unquote on behalf of his brother, that also will go to his brother because he had no right to be inside of that property. Okay, I'm going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Mem Amud Aleph.